Thank you.
Yes, ecumenicalism and unity. I'm going to leap straight into the subject, actually. No introduction. We'll go straight down to it. Banti has pointed out two things. Two of his emphases are... I'm already slipping into jargon, aren't I? Banti has expressed that there are six emphases let's start again. Stop that. We'll go back to the beginning. Don't worry about it. We'll work our way through it. Banti has said that there are six emphases that are placed by the FWBO-WBO that make it a distinct movement. Last night we heard one of those. The first of these emphases is that the FWBO puts a lot of importance on the centrality of going for refuge to the three jewels. The second of these emphases is that the FWBO is an ecumenical Buddhist movement. And the third of these emphases is that the FWBO-WBO is a unified movement. So these are the two emphases I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to talk about the fact that the FWBO-WBO is an ecumenical Buddhist movement. And then after that, I'm going to talk about the fact that the FWBO-WBO is a unified Buddhist movement. So, let's get on to the first of those. Banti has pointed out that we are an ecumenical Buddhist movement. Now, I should make it quite clear from the beginning that this does not mean that we are a Christian Buddhist movement. Even though the word ecumenical does refer to the worldwide unity of Christian churches, I think we need to make it quite clear, I hope you understand this, that we are not a Christian movement, neither we a Buddhist Christian nor a Christian Buddhist movement. Banti is, of course, using the word in the rather rarer meaning of universal. So we are a universal Buddhist movement. In fact, the word ecumenical derives from an expression meaning that people inhabit one house. So I think that gives you some idea of what he means. It's as though we inhabit the Buddhist house. We're part of the Buddhist family. Now, as you know, in a family, people are quite different. But they live together, give or take. They live together in harmony in one house. So this is the idea of ecumenical. It means that we live together in one house. We are, as it were, as one family. So we inhabit the same house as other Buddhists. In practice, our ecumenicalism means the following, and this is a quote from Banti. The word signifies that in principle we accept the whole Buddhist tradition as it has developed over the centuries in the East. It means that we do not identify ourselves exclusively with any one Eastern sect or tradition. We learn from all, we appreciate all, and we are inspired by all. So there are two main points here. The first is that we accept the whole Buddhist tradition as it has developed over the centuries in the East. And secondly, it means that we do not identify ourselves exclusively with any one Eastern sect or tradition. Those are the two main points. So, this actually all sounds pretty straightforward, doesn't it? And probably pretty appealing. After all, it's very non-dogmatic, and it's all-encompassing. It seems very straightforward, very clear. But is it quite as straightforward as this? Let's just look into it a little bit. And I'm going to start by looking at the second one, the fact that we do not identify ourselves exclusively with any one Eastern sect or tradition. Now, many, many years ago, about 25 years ago, I asked Banti what to me was a very important question. I asked him on whose authority he started the FWBO. Now, at that time, I was wondering about this man, Sangharakshita. I was actually already in the order at this time, but I was still wondering about him. I was wondering what his game was. You know, What was he actually up to? I was also wondering if he was right in what he said about Buddhism. I mean, I didn't know anything about Buddhism. And I'd met this chap, you know, on this retreat, claiming to be a Buddhist, saying all these things about Buddhism. I didn't really know whether he was giving me the Buddhist line or not. I could read a few books and check it up and it seemed okay, but I couldn't really be certain. I needed to know if he was right in what he said. I needed to know, in a way, if he spoke with the authority of Buddhism. This was particularly important when he was saying some things that I didn't feel at all comfortable about. Like, for example, that I should be thinking of living in a single-sex community. This I found, you know, quite unacceptable and undesirable at that time. And so I was just wondering, well, is this really Buddhism? You know, is it really Buddhism to live in single-sex communities? Or should I carry on with my girlfriend or girlfriends, whatever the, you know, whatever week it was? So, in the end, I asked him, who sent him to England to start the FWBO? Or at least, who gave him the authority to do it? And he looked me straight in the eye, with a little glint in the eye, and he said, no one, I decided to do it myself. His answer actually shook me to the core. On the one hand, I was a bit of an individualist, so I was kind of pleased with his answer. You know, it was quite a groovy answer, really. But also, I was amazed at his confidence. He didn't try and give me any kind of fluff. He just said, no, I decided to do it myself. That's why I did it. I was stunned at his confidence that he should just come and start a new Buddhist movement, as it were, without the backing of a church. And I was also amazed that our movement had no firm foundation of institutional authority. And, gentlemen, it still doesn't. In a way, we don't have any foundation of institutional authority. There's no institution anywhere else in the world that has ever said, let there be the FWBO, or let us create the FWBO. It's been created out of the inspiration of Sangharakshita and others. When Banti said this to me, I felt a kind of wave of preety go running across my back. I felt an incredible confidence in my teacher. At that point, I sort of think his confidence came across and it hit me. And I decided that, well, I shared his confidence. I was confident in my teacher for no other reason than the fact that I felt confident in him. He didn't have the Dalai Lama's stamp of approval. He didn't even say that he had his teacher's stamp of approval, although I later discovered that he did discuss coming to the UK with Dado Rinpoche and others. I felt confident and I felt liberated and I felt clean and clear, free of the confines, just to go ahead and help create this new movement. I was very happy then, and since then I've never had any doubts about my teacher. So we do not identify with any Eastern sect or tradition. We stand alone, but we stand firmly rooted in the Buddhist tradition. Our roots, we might be a single tree, as it were, but we stand rooted in the earth of the Dharma. Banti has also said that we accept the whole of the Buddhist tradition. But do we accept the whole of the Buddhist tradition? Do we accept all teachings and practices of the Buddhist tradition? For eight examples. Do we accept that you must be ordained according to the Vinaya to be a real Buddhist? If you do, and this is part of the Buddhist tradition, it's a real problem for you, because you're not going to be ordained according to the Vinaya. Therefore, according to Eastern tradition, you won't be a real Buddhist. Number two, do we accept that ordination for women is now totally impossible, and that they are therefore barred from serious spiritual practice? This is part of Eastern Buddhism. Many countries' Buddhists believe this very strongly. If we believe it, then, well, none of us, but certainly our sisters in the order, will have a serious problem. Thirdly, the view that without initiation, tantric initiation, one's practice is corrupt. This is part of some schools, this view. Well, we can't get tantric initiation from your teachers. You're not going to get tantric initiation. The initiation that you get at ordination is not a tantric initiation. So, if you want tantric initiation, if you feel that you can't practice without it, well, then there's a serious problem. Another teaching that comes from another school in the East is that the White Lotus Sutra is the only real teaching. All the earlier sutras are incomplete and actually misleading. Do we believe that? Do we believe that we should take the advice of some meditation teachers and only meditate, avoiding at all costs the corrupting study of Buddhist texts? Do we accept the view of some modern academic Buddhists, supported by Buddhists in the East, that meditation just generates woolly thinking and a superstitious and mystical mind which corrupts the clear, sharp thinking needed for insight? Do we believe that the Mahayana is corrupt and that the Vajrayana is even more corrupt, whereas the Hinayana is just a lesser teaching for those who are spiritually immature? These are all teachings coming from Eastern traditions. Do we accept them? If we accept those teachings, which I hope we don't, then the whole tradition, then we open ourselves up to some quite serious problems, some quite serious confusions, at least if we only look at them superficially. For example, if we look at Japanese Buddhism, we'll find on the one hand there's the Zen school. The Zen school emphasizes effort, discipline, drive, push, cutting off from the world, going into a monastery, working hard, not stopping, keeping on going, working hard with the teacher, zap, 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 you know, really pushing, thrusting, thumping your way to enlightenment. The Pure Land school says, you're saved already. Amitabha has already saved you. You know, so, there's not much problem really. You don't really need to do anything. You know, you've already been saved. You're already enlightened. So, you know, just lead a good life. You know, get on with your family and career and just, you know, poodle along being a good Buddhist. Two schools of Buddhism. Quite confusing, at least if looked at only superficially. If we start to study Tibetan Buddhism, for example, I hope I'm not putting you all off, but if you start to study Tibetan Buddhism, you might get really interested in Tsongkhapa. You know, there's lots and lots to read, lots of books to read, lots to study. Tsongkhapa puts an incredible emphasis on having a broad experience of the whole tradition. That's what you're going to devote your life to. The study of all the sutras, all the tantras, all the shastras, everything. Get it all packed in there. Know it all. You know, be a true follower of Tsongkhapa. But then you come across Milarepa. While you're studying all these texts of Tsongkhapa, you come across Milarepa. Milarepa, one gets the impression that he couldn't even read. All he did was went off in the mountains and meditate. Lived an incredibly hard life. So what are we going to do? Are you going to settle in the monastery and study? Or are you going to go in the mountains and live in a cave? But then you start thinking, well, maybe Padmasambhava. You know, Padmasambhava wore all these fantastic robes, you know, and he could do all the magical stuff. He started monasteries and he dealt with demons. I mean, he had a really kind of, you know, cracking life. I mean, he really sort of got out there and engaged with it all. Entered into the whole of samsaric existence, transforming it all magically. Which of those are you going to follow? Tsongkhapa, Milarepa, or Padmasambhava? They're all heads of schools. They all have incredible weight and authority. But which one of them is the right one? So, in what way do we accept the teachings and practices of the whole Buddhist tradition? Clearly, we can't do it just superficially. We have to look at those teachers and practices critically. But how? What kind of criticism, what kind of system of criticism can we apply to those teachings? Well, we have to learn to think and reflect for ourselves. and we have to refer to the wise. One could give a whole talk on what is meant by the wise. In fact, it would be a great talk to give, I think. I can't go into it now. I'll say a little bit about it later on. But what I'm suggesting is that we do have to think and reflect very deeply for ourselves. We live under certain conditions. We live under certain conditions of the weather. The weather here, today particularly, is very different from the weather in India. It's very different from the weather in Tibet. It's even different from the weather in Japan. We live under certain conditions. We live under the conditions of the weather. But we live under other climates as well. We live in a particular economic climate where there are various winds of economic change. We live in a particular socio-sexual climate where there are different attitudes towards sexuality. We live in a very particular and unique intellectual climate where our approach to things intellectually is quite unique. So, for example, living the lifestyle outlined in the Vinaya is probably not appropriate for our weather, nor our economic climate. You know, wandering around here in one robe, going round the village of Sirningham with one bowl, I don't think we'd be able to establish this kind of community. So we may not accept that living according to the Vinaya is the only way to live the Buddhist life. However, we do accept the principles of a simple, harmless, and chaste life. It was this simple, harmless, chaste life that motivated the early monks, and it's still a goal that we respect and to varying degrees desire to emulate. But we will do it in a way that's appropriate to our weather, our economic climate, and so on. Another example, we live in the intellectual climate of the higher criticism. We have an approach to criticism that's to do with literature, to do with language, to do with history. With these perspectives, the historical and the linguistic, we can criticise the Buddhist text. We can look at the Buddhist text from a particular historical and linguistic angle. Now, this means that we cannot accept teachings as literally as they were accepted in other times and places, in other Buddhist cultures. For us, it's impossible to accept certain things literally because we have this higher, this broader perspective. For example, traditionally the Mahayana and Vajrayana schools, the teachings of those schools, are seen as being the actual words of the Buddha. Within those traditions, the followers of them believe that these teachings were actually given verbally by the Buddha. We can't believe that. We can't generally accept that. However, we can see these schools in their historical and literary context and still value them. We don't have to insist on literal understandings. So, we have to investigate the teachings and practices of all Buddhist traditions, and we must ask how they're relevant to us in our practice. However, a warning. We must be careful not to pick and choose the teachings just because we like or dislike them. For example, when reading the life of Milarepa, we might like this idea of a free life, you know, wandering around from place to place. We might find that very attractive, so we might sort of tend to choose that. But we may not like the fact that he's celibate and lived for much of his life working very hard for his teacher for years and years and years, and then went to live without any food in the mountain for years and years more. We will take the, you know, the free wandering spirit of Milarepa, but we don't want the graft. Well, we mustn't make these kind of distinctions just on the basis of likes and dislikes. Another warning is we shouldn't approach unpopular references with superficial resolutions. For example, if we take the Buddha's attitude to the ordination of women, I won't go into what it is, but it's outlined in Bhante's talk, The Wreath of Blue Lotuses. If we look at the Buddha's attitude towards the ordination of women, we might find, well, culturally, we might find this is unacceptable. It doesn't actually fit in with our cultural view of what the Buddha ought to feel like towards women and the nuns. We say, therefore, well, the Buddha, poor chap, was just a product of the unenlightened social views that were around at his time, and he was under their influence. So the poor old Buddha didn't really see the true nature of what was going on with women. He was dominated, he was conditioned by his social environment, and that's why he said these things. So we can just forget about them. I'll put this in. This is an interesting little thing I discovered. And I think the reason I give this is to illustrate how important it is to actually think about the Dharma. There are a certain list of Mahayana precepts, one of which says that the Bodhisattva should never refuse a woman, and you know in what way I mean, if to do so would offend her. Yeah? Now we think, wow, this is interesting. I think I might take that precept on. Because in our mind, what we've got in mind is some, you know, young, attractive woman who just cannot bear to be refused by us, or young, attractive man, we can make that correspondence, and we think, well, that will be okay, I'll go with that. But what the precept is that the Bodhisattva should never refuse a woman if to do so would offend her. Now, this includes older women, fatter women, ugly women, women with their face covered with sores, leprous women, women on their deathbed. That's what it means. It means if you can do that, if you can really function as a Bodhisattva, well then you can take on that precept. But if you can't, then go back to the old one. See what I mean? You have to think about these things. We tend to take our own preconceptions, our own prejudices, and leap forward. But let's really think about the teachings fully. Think what they really mean. So it's a problem, isn't it? Deciding what is the right teaching. How to practice a teaching. However, we can, as usual, go back to basic Buddhist teachings, and we can look at what the Buddha taught to the Kalamas. Surita mentioned this briefly yesterday in his talk, but I'm going to say just a little bit more about it. The Kalamas, you'll remember, were a tribe of people who at that time were inundated with all sorts of different teachers, people from all different kinds of traditions. They had teachings coming out of their ear holes, and they just didn't know what to do with them. They didn't know which to accept and which to reject. So, sensible people that they were, they went to see the Buddha. And they asked the Buddha his opinion on which teachings should be accepted and which should be rejected. And this was the answer that the Buddha gave. He said, "Of course you are uncertain, Kalamas. Of course you are in doubt. When there are reasons for doubt, uncertainty is born. So, in this case, Kalamas, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement with each other through pondering views, by probability, or by the thought, this contemplative is our teacher. When you know for yourselves that these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticized by the wise, these qualities, when undertaken and carried out, lead to harm and to suffering, then you should abandon them." One could talk for a week on this paragraph by going through each of those ways in which one should not judge a teaching. I've done this with Bhante over a period of several days, and what one finds happening is all one's bases for establishing the authority of something get undermined. Everything gets destroyed. And you're basically left with Shraddha. You're basically left with your response to the teaching and your imagined imagination, because you the Buddha has said that when these qualities are criticized by the wise, well, we don't really know who the wise are. The Buddha doesn't say that. So what we have to do is imagine the wise. We just have to imagine who they are and see what they would respond to something. Or we have to find those that we consider slightly more wise than us, or lots more wise than us, those people that we know that we can go and talk to about it and consider their opinions. But take none of these things on authority. In the end, it comes back to our own response of shraddha, of faith, whether we know something is right or not. Is it essential that one wears the yellow robe and begs from house to house to follow the spiritual life? I don't think it is. That's my response. That's the response of those that I trust as well. So therefore, I don't really think that that is part of the essential teachings of the Buddha. Although, of course, the fact that people do that is great. There's nothing against them actually doing it. Do you see what I mean? In the Kalama Sutta, the Buddha then goes on to give an example of applying this method, which is well worth reading. I don't have time to go into it now. But we have to ask this same question. Or we can even put it in our own language. We can say, will this teaching, or will it not, support my attempts to go more deeply for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha? That's the question that we have to ask. That's the importance of what Surita was stressing last night, the centrality of going for refuge. That's the only thing that we don't change in our order. What we have to do with everything else is say, does this thing help me and others to go for refuge more deeply to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha or not? That is the crucial question. We can think and reflect for ourselves on this question, and we can also ask the wise to consider it. In other words, we can discuss it with those who are a little more wise than ourselves, or we can actually just ask ourselves, well, what would the Buddha say in this situation? I think that works quite well quite often. Particularly if you have a strong sense of connection with the Buddha, you can basically ask him. You can ask the Buddha in your imagination, what would he do? What would he say in this particular situation? And sometimes you can get a very helpful, shocking and challenging answer. So, thus again, we go back to basic principles. And we go back to the basic principles in the Pali Suttas in order to help us work our way through this jungle of teachings and practices of the schools of the East. So, yes, we are an ecumenical movement. We are an ecumenical Buddhist movement. But we must apply our critical judgment to those teachings and practices of the Buddhist tradition. And also, we must develop strength and confidence to realise that we are not exclusively identified with any Eastern sect or tradition. We are, in fact, a new school of Buddhism that's firmly rooted in the traditions of the old schools. Let me move on now to the question of unity. Banti has said that we are a unified movement in a general sense, and this is a quote, and in a specific sense. In a general sense, membership of the FWBO TBMSG is open to all. It's open to all regardless of nationality, race, colour, education, class or caste, cultural background, gender, sexual orientation, or age. Banti also says, I hope I've covered everything, otherwise someone is sure to find fault. He goes on to say, all are accepted, all are welcomed, all have a place. All are seen and valued by themselves and by others, primarily as individuals. In a specific sense, he goes on to say, we are a unified movement in that membership of the order, which is the heart of the movement, is open to both men and women on equal terms. So, again, the FWBO is a unified movement. Again, this sounds very politically correct and is therefore very attractive, or quite attractive, or moderately attractive, to those of us brought up in a thoroughly liberal culture. It goes along quite nicely with our views. It sounds as if the FWBO is all-inclusive and democratic. In fact, a thoroughly good liberal institution. But is it? Maybe it does have some of the characteristics of a thoroughly good liberal institution. But it's not unified because the Buddha subscribed to modern liberal views. Now, this may come as a shock to many people, but this is actually the case. The Buddha was not a liberal. It may be that it's actually purely a coincidence that liberal values and Buddhist values agree. For the sake of being devil's advocate here, I suspect that if one lived in a society that was dominated by even a fascist dictatorship, one could still find things within the Buddhist tradition with which one agreed. I'll leave you to discuss that in your discussion groups. This is because Buddhism is not a liberal, is not motivated by modern liberal views, because Buddhism is not founded on ideas of equality. It's not even founded on ideas of equality of opportunity. Though, of course, Buddhism may have no argument with these ideas in general. The FWBO is unified because it is based on the values of Buddhism. Our movement is unified because a unified spiritual community is one in which the members do not identify themselves as this or that kind of person. Or if they do, they only do it provisionally. They don't see themselves as equal to each other. We don't see ourselves as equal to each other. We don't demand equal rights within the order. And we don't insist on the group with which we identify, albeit provisionally, as needing to be properly represented in the order. We are simply aspiring individuals who realise the necessity of associating with other aspiring individuals. Again, to go into this a little more deeply, let's go back to the Pali Canon. Let's look at what the Buddha has to say on this matter. Let's consider the well-known quarrel at Kosambi. This is described as in Nyanamoli's Life of the Buddha, and it's from the Vinaya. It's from the Mahavagga in the Vinaya. So, a short description of the situation. This is what happened, if I remember it in detail. In a particular location, there were two quite senior teachers, one of whom was an expert in the suttas, and one of whom was an expert in the Vinaya. One knew the rules and regulations for the monks, and the other one knew lots of stories and things about the Buddha, lots of teachings about the Buddha, but wasn't so up on the rules and regulations. Anyway, the sutta teacher went, as you know, one does, to the bathroom. He went to the loo. When he went to the loo, he left the water pot for washing in the loo. Later on, the Vinaya master came along, noticed the pot in the loo, and said to the sutta teacher, sutta master, "Did you leave the water washing pot in the loo?" And the sutta teacher said, "Well, yes, I did." And the Vinaya master said, "Well, you know, you shouldn't have done that, according to the Vinaya." And the sutta master said, "Oh, well, I'm terribly sorry, I didn't know that. I'll take it away." And the Vinaya master said, "Oh, well, if you didn't know, then you didn't break the rule." So the sutta master said, "Oh, okay," and went about his business. Later on, the Vinaya master went to his disciples and said, you know that sutta master, he doesn't understand the Vinaya. He doesn't even know that you shouldn't leave the pot in the toilet." So the disciples of the Vinaya master get all uppity. They go to the disciples of the sutta master and say, "You know, your master's not much good. He doesn't even know that you shouldn't leave the pot in the loo." the Sutta Master's disciples go to the Sutta Master and said, the Vinaya Master and all of his pupils are saying that you don't understand the Dhamma because you left the pot in the loo and broke one of the rules. And the Sutta Master said, well, no, I didn't break one of the rules. And then the disciples went back to the disciples of the Vinaya Master and said, he didn't break one of the rules. They went to their teacher and said, the Sutta Master says he didn't break one of the rules. The Vinaya Master said, well, they did. And so it started. That was how it started. It's a small thing. You're aware of how little things start things. And so it started to build and build and build. And apparently it got to blows. People, they were actually fighting over in the general bad atmosphere that was created by this. This went on for some time. They were unable to resolve it. And it finished up actually by the Vinaya Master kicking the Sutta Master out of the order. The Buddha was eventually called in to try and resolve it. He called people from both sides and they said, look, Buddha, this is none of your business. We'll get this sorted out. You know, this is nothing to do with you. They rejected their teacher. The Buddha said, look, if you don't sort this out, think what you're losing. And this is the important bit. He said, you will not be able to meet together as a spiritual community. That was his reason. He said, you won't be able to come together if you argue and if you experience disharmony in this way. And coming together is a crucial and essential part of the spiritual practice. They still ignored the Buddha. The story goes on. It's quite a long story, as these things usually are. Probably lasted years. In the end, it did have a happy ending. And how the happy ending came about, which is interesting, is that the local people got so fed up with this argument amongst the bhikkhus that they refused to feed any of them. Once their source of food had gone, then they decided that they'd get it sorted out. But again, there's a lesson to be learned there. But the point was that the Buddha didn't say, you know, look chaps, just be nice to each other. He said, if you don't experience harmony, you won't be able to come together on the half moon nights and make your confessions. That was his main point. You won't be able to come together and practice together. That was the point that he made. He asked them to reflect on the value that they got from practicing with each other, on the value they experienced from being part of a community. And that was his reason for insisting on their unity. So, the Buddha exhorts the monks to restore harmony, to unify themselves so that they can meet and practice together. This is the crucial point. Now, we all have a tendency to group ourselves with this or that party. We feel ourselves to be of a particular kind of person, this or that kind of person, and we tend to form a party with other people. No, I don't mean kind of, you know, drinks and cakes type party. I mean a political type party. We politicize ourselves. We form a grouping with people that we feel are similar to us. This is a natural tendency. But it's something that we need to work against. Every single Buddhist is unavoidably born into a particular human form, which he or she will have for the whole of their life. And this particular form has got certain characteristics. For example, it will be of a particular gender. You can't get away with it. I mean, you might be a little confused about your gender, but you've got one. You've got a gender. At any one time, you have a particular gender. You're also born into a particular race, a particular class, and a particular caste, or class or caste. And you will be born under the government and protection of a particular body politic. It could be a tribe, it could be a city-state, it could be a kingdom, or, in the present era, it could be a particular nation. So you do have a nationality. He or she will also have a particular sexual orientation. He or she will have a particular education. And, also, Each one of us will live in a particular way. We will have, each of us, a particular lifestyle. However, as Buddhists, we are trying, among other things, to resist fixedly identifying with any of these categories. We recognize the facts of our conditioned existence, but we make the effort to overcome our fixed identification with these conditions. We're trying to become true individuals, free from all but a provisional identification with these individual personal characteristics. Now, to achieve this freedom, to achieve this liberation, we need to interact with others also working towards this freedom. We have to move out of a world of conflicting groups into something else in order to really experience ourselves as a free individual. In short, we need a spiritual community. We can't do it without a spiritual community. And in this spiritual community, none of the members is over-identified with their particular characteristics, their particular personal characteristics. We need a community of true, or at least aspiring, individuals who are unified by what is deepest in them, not bound by the superficial characteristics of their existence, like gender, nation, race, caste or class, and so on. So, in the FWBO and WBO, we try to stand as individuals relating to each other on the basis of our shared going for refuge to the three jewels. This is what unifies us, and this is what we need to come together for. When we come together as a spiritual community, we come together on the basis of relating going for refuge to going for refuge. And in this way, we can experience ourselves more deeply. This is quite an important point. Simply speaking, and this is a simplification, I know, each of us has two parts, a higher and a lower self. The higher self goes for refuge to the three jewels, and the other, the lower self, is identified with all sorts of other things. And we are both of these. We are a higher self and we are a lower self. The spiritual community is in essence the relationship that exists between our higher selves. That's what the spiritual community is in essence. But of course, our lower selves also interrelate. So we have this dual level. Of course, one can't really talk in terms of levels, but for the sake of trying to get it clear, we've got this spiritual relationship that occurs, and then our kind of ordinary selves. The trick is to try and resist the lower self's attempt to form groupings with those like oneself, because these affiliations will tend to break the unity of the movement. And we have to work towards maintaining awareness of our individuality and, therefore, of the spiritual benefits that we share with each other when we relate on the basis of our individuality. So that, I believe, is the principle of unity within the order. So, is the FWBO unified? Is it open to all? Is it open to men and women? Well, I think it is. And I was quite taken once by a remark made by a Theravadan monk, one called Ratanasara, an old friend actually of Bhante's, at a conference I was at in the mid-80s. Nagabodhi was there as well, actually, and he gave a slideshow on our work in India. And one of the pictures in the slideshow was a whole room full of women meditating. Now, to us, this isn't anything in particular, this is nothing, no big thing, perhaps. But to people in India, this is enormous. The idea of a woman meditating is rather like a dog singing. It doesn't happen. It happens rarely, and when it does happen, it's not very good. That would be the general Indian attitude towards women practicing the Dharma. Here was a whole room of women obviously meditating. This monk stood up in the middle of the slideshow, waved his arms around and said, "This is it. This is the new Theravada. This is the new Theravada." He was ecstatic that he'd seen all of these women meditating. He couldn't believe it. So we have gone a long way to We've gone a very long way to opening our order to men and women, much, much further than any of us, I think, really fully realise, and certainly much further than people outside of our movement realise. We're criticised sometimes by those that have a far worse record than we ourselves. Secondly, our movement is open to people of all sexual orientations. I think this again is also fairly obvious. One only has to glance around this room to see the delightful truth of it. There was a point even when I was in the States when people, I said, oh, I'm from the FWPO. And they said, oh, that's that English gay Buddhist movement, isn't it? The FWBO is open to all nationalities. Again, we only have to look around this room. We've got people from many nationalities. Not enough. We need more. There's a lot more work to be done. We've got many nationalities that are not involved in our order. We want them involved. We should be thinking much, much more about taking the Dharma to other countries. This should be much more a topic within our minds. Again, all of us in this room, we could be thinking about, you know, at some time or other in the future, taking the Dharma to another country. I mean, I've done it. It's great fun. It's incredibly hard work, but it builds character. Our order is open to all colours and races. A large proportion of the movement is, of course, Indian. I think there's probably more Indians involved in our movement than there are Europeans. In the order, there's a very high proportion. I don't know exactly what it is. Probably about a quarter of the order members are Indian. So it's certain that our movement does contain people of different colours and different races. But we could still go a long way towards strengthening this, towards bringing more people of different races into our movement, more people of different colours, in the same way as nationalities. And even with our brothers and sisters in India, there's a lot more that we could do about strengthening those ties. We still have a way to go. A lot has been done, and we'll hear, no doubt, more about this later this evening. The FWBO is open to all ages. In the West, the movement was started by young people. And it's, as the movement developed, those young people, quodis demonstrandum, have got older. And they will continue to get older. So in a few years' time, probably about 10, we'll have a movement in which there's quite a lot of pretty old people, as well as hopefully some young people. Then, of course, we might have to look at issues maybe developing around age. There are people with different levels of education, wealth and skills in our order, and this is great. There are also people with different lifestyles. We have people living with their home at home with their families, working at their careers. We have some living in single-sex communities, working in team-based right livelihood projects, of which we'll hear more later tonight, and some living rather more independently, but especially devoted to their work of going for refuge to the Three Jewels. So we're building a unified movement. It's not an easy thing to achieve, particularly as we get bigger and try to include more and more and more different types of people. I'll finish off by just talking about a few of the struggles that we've had. There has been a struggle over the issue of men and women. The effective integration of men and women, and I mean the effective integration. You know, we could have created just a nice kind of social group with men and women hanging around together, but that wouldn't have been very effective spiritually. What we have now is an effective integration of men and women into the order. That was difficult to establish. And it took a period of, you know, 5 or so years in the mid-70s in which it was quite difficult, quite painful for a lot of people. There was a lot of hard work had to be done in order to achieve what we'd now take very much for granted. But I think we can be proud of now having a movement and an order that involves men and women on an equitable but not equal basis. I'll say that again. The men and women are involved on an equitable but not an equal basis. Men and women are different. I've investigated it. They are different. Anyone that says otherwise is quite frankly a fool. What that difference is rather more difficult to say. Superficially, one can say quite easily. But what the real differences are is actually quite difficult to establish. But different they are. And a difference requires a difference. As men, we need a particular set of conditions in which to thrive spiritually. We need certain sorts of relationships. We need a certain climate. We need an environment which supports a particular set of moods. We need a certain quality of spirit. We need surroundings to support us to develop what is best as men. We start with our manliness, and then from that we develop into Buddhas. Bansi has made the point that the movement is not a unisex movement. We don't want a movement of men trying to be women or women trying to be men. What we want is a movement of real men and real women all working hard in their own ways to become real stream entrants. The struggle for nationality, to unify on the basis of nationality. We definitely need to retain a feeling of unity between those of different nationalities. And I think this is going to continue to require a lot of effort in future years. It's something I think that we're going to have to work on more and more over the next few decades. In the United States, for example, there was a time when there was a slight antagonism between certain American and certain British order members, and I confess to being one of them. This antagonism was based on an over-identification with respective nationalities. And there was even, for a while, a slight antagonism between those living on the West Coast and those living on the East Coast. Yeah? Now, at distance, we can find that interesting. But we also have to consider, do we do that ourselves? You know, Scotland and England are not that far apart, but antagonism can exist. You know, Wales and England. I don't know. Various examples. Various things can spark those antagonisms initially. Teeny things. Remember the situation at Kasambi. All over a water pot in the toilet. Something really big developed out of that. So this is something that we have to watch very, very carefully. A comment on lifestyle. Something like this might happen. Somebody who's been working in a team-based right livelihood project, living in a men's community, might decide to leave. He might decide to go live with his girlfriend and get a job. Now, this could be the cause of some antagonism. There could be a feeling that this chap is letting the side down in some way, that he's no longer a real Buddhist. This is clearly something we have to be very, very careful of. What we have to ask is not how is this man living his life. We have to ask, is he effectively going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha? The lifestyle is not the crucial element. We might get those living a more worldly life, sort of sitting back in their armchairs, you know, putting their feet up and having a cup of tea, turning off the telly for a few minutes, and criticising the failures of our attempts to set up semi-monastic lifestyles and institutions. They may not fully appreciate the difficulty and effort that's being made to establish these institutions. So again, the criticism might be there between lifestyles. You might, for example, get anagarikas looking down on those who are not practicing celibacy as not doing it properly. Certainly don't get anagarikas in this room doing that. You might also get those that are not practicing brahmacharya being very unsympathetic and assuming impure motives of those that do practice it. You know, oh, he's practicing it because he's like screwed up sexually. Of course he can't, you know, that's his problem. Also, I don't think anybody in this room would do that, but those are the sort of things we need to look for. Age. A quick word about age. We have to avoid the tendency to have ageism in the movement as we grow, as we have a broader range of ages. I think what we particularly have to be aware of is the tendency of the elderly to be overcritical of the young. I must say my mum thinks that everything that's wrong in the world is the problem is caused by young people. Do you know, it's definitely young people that are causing all these problems in the world. And this has been going on for centuries. I remember reading something from Roman times where one senator was complaining about the youth and how they were, you know, the whole place was going to the dogs because of young people. And the young amongst us have to be very careful to avoid losing respect for the elderly. You know, I'm afraid as time goes on, we're going to get a bit doddery. We're going to forget things. We're going to fluff up in the puja. We're going to, we're going to trip over a bit more. We're not going to be quite so concerned about our appearance. You know, things are going to gradually start to go downhill, and then it's going to get really bad towards the end. But don't just say, oh God, you know, Mandravajra, chuck him out of here. Just think, well, you know, poor old Mandravajra, he's a bit of a wreck now, but, you know, he did a thing or two in his time. So give him a cup of tea, you know, put him on his cushion and let him meditate. Just a bit of respect for the elderly as we start to crack up. So we have a unified order and a unified movement. It's a simple thing to say, but a very difficult thing to do. Very, very difficult thing to do. I think that we've already shown some considerable success in our pursuit of this goal, but we've got a long way to go. And as the movement develops, becomes bigger, brings in more people of different types, which it must do, it's going to be even more difficult to maintain our unity. There has never before been an attempt to create a worldwide Buddhist spiritual community on the scale that we're attempting to do with our order. This order will encompass so many different people from both sexes, from many races, both sexes and in between, many races and many, many nationalities. So we've got a big job on our hands, all of us. Everybody in this room has got this job on their hands. May we be successful.